all right? Yeah? Okay, perfect. So thank you for the coordinators for inviting me to give this talk today, and also for those of you that invited me to the Q Bio, Clara Wyatt especially brought me into the fold, so to speak. So thank you for that. It's really an honor. Today I'm going to talk about some of my research on how fish swim, and we're going to talk about various projects, some that are more kind of finalized than others. Others we just started to look at. But in essence, I study how fish swim in unsteady flows. And so you see here on the screen, there's these two wild brook trout, Salvelinus fontinalis, that they're swimming in this mountain river. And that's going to be kind of the jumping off point from what we're going to talk about for the rest of the talk. So a couple questions that we'll address in the talk. One is, how and why do fish swim in unsteady flows? Change in a point in time, in a particular space, it changes over time. So unlike a steady state or a laminar flow, something that changes across time. And I'll talk about the mechanics and the energetics of this, as well as getting a little bit into feeding ecology and kind of maybe the control strategy of how you might grab food while you're swimming in these unsteady flows. Then we're going to talk about the role of this flow-sensitive lateral line system that some of you might have heard about already. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the response properties of the lateral line, some interesting experiments we're doing with robotics to better understand this, and the efferent system, the system to be able to gain down the sensitivity of the lateral line system. And so fish locomotion has a kind of long, rich history. Aristotle studied it, movement of animals. Borelli, who was a student of Galileo, studied it. E.J. Marais made important contributions because he pioneered cinematography, as well as the biologist C.M. Breeder, who classified different modes of locomotion depending on the species of fishes. So because fish locomotion is potentially complex, there's hydrodynamics, there's physiology, there's biomechanics, they studied it in very kind of simple environments. It's still water or smooth laminar flow. And I would argue that this is not the only environment that fishes have evolved to be. And so fish and I have kind of a long storied history. It started out when my parents immigrated over from Taiwan, and we'd go fishing in the East River in New York City. We'd catch like these eels and snapper blues and flounder. And throughout my life, I kind of was an angler and observed animals in the field. I think anglers, I was talking to Ann the other day, anglers and hunters are kind of the original neuroethologists, right? Like, you really need to know what the animal is doing, because your livelihood kind of depends on it. And so when I got to Florida as an assistant professor about 9 years ago, I did what I thought would be a great idea, which is I signed up for these professional bass fishing tournaments. Right? So you actually go and you pay lots of money and you drive a big boat and you have sponsors and you try to catch as many fish as you can in 4 days, and the winner takes home like $100,000 or something like that. So I figured, okay, I know enough about fish behavior, I'll do this. And so it's interesting to me because the people that do this full time, they have day jobs. They work in lawn care, or they're construction people, or they're plumbers, and they don't know a Mallinger cell from a circumferential, descending glutamatergic interneuron in the spinal cord. They don't know any of this stuff. They don't know a premaxilla bone from a maxilla bone. But if you were to ask them where these fish are on any given day, whatever the species are, they would tell you. And how do they do that, right? And not only that, they can tell you, if the fish are going to be feeding from 7 to 8 o'clock on surface baits or underwater baits. And they'll tell you, throw a 6-inch worm with a curly tail. Don't throw a straight tail worm. And so they are really tuned into the behavior of the animals. So I feel like I'm in kind of two different worlds. I'm like 1 foot in the science world and the other foot in the angling world. And both kind of populations know a lot about fish behavior. I kind of want to bring the two together a little bit. So there aren't that many rules when it comes to fishing, but one of them is, if you really want to find fish, go to where there's water flow. So this is like the central dogma if you talk to anglers. It's like you go to a new lake, you want to figure out where the fish are, see if there's a stream coming into the lake or whatnot. Like, if you find moving water, that's where you're going to find fish. So this is not only the case in bass fishing, but also in fly fishing. So this is a video I took in New Zealand, just to show you that water moves, right? Whether it's the tide that's moving in and out on a coral reef, or it's a river, water generally moves. And if you were to stick a camera underwater, you'd see that fish like these places. They're not just avoiding all this turbulence. These are two brown trout as they're jockeying for position behind this rock here. Right? And so they like to be here. You could chase them away, they'll come back to that same rock. Right? So something interesting is going on here. And so what I wanted to do as a scientist was try to bring in some of this complexity into the lab so I could actually study it. And so what I did was I decided to take advantage of a phenomenon known as Karman vortex stream. So anytime you have water moving past a bluff body, you know, this time it's a cylinder cut in half lengthwise, we call it a D cylinder. If you put that in flow, you'll have what's called a von Karman vortex street, this array of vortices that are shed behind it. And the beautiful thing about Karman vortex streets are they're found anywhere you really care to look. So this is a von Karman vortex street as visualized by a satellite photo and clouds on the lee side of Guadalupe Island. So for a certain range of Reynolds number, which is this dimensionless number that describes the inertial viscous forces, you're going to see this kind of shedding of staggered vortices. And the nice thing about vortex streets is you can describe them fairly simply. There's a wake wavelength that is a downstream, upstream spacing of the vortices. And then there's also a shedding frequency, right? Which is simply how fast they're shedding off that cylinder. So I thought this would be a great way to try to understand how fish swim in unsteady flows. So here you have Mr. Rainbow Trout behind this D cylinder. And if we look kind of top down at a schematic, you'll see kind of Vortex Street 101. All right, so basically you have the cylinder, flow moving from left to right generates the staggered array of vortices. Red represents counterclockwise flow. Blue is clockwise flow. You see they're staggered and they're alternating. Because of the direction in which these vortices are spinning, you're going to have a region kind of in the midline of this wake that has a reduced velocity. And I've tried to show this with these smaller arrows between this kind of sinusoidal lines. So this is all to say that if I dropped like a floating stick in the middle here, it would still float downstream, right? The flow is still going downstream. It would just float downstream more slowly than if I put the stick outside of the wake. There is a region, for those of you that kayak in the room, known as the perception zone, right, where water flow actually does move back upstream. Right? And this region is about 2 diameters downstream of this cylinder. So if I drop a stick over here, it would actually get kind of caught up in here, kind of bounce around a little bit, and then get kicked out and float downstream. So the equations that kind of govern, you know, the cylinder wake dynamics is fairly simple. There's a Struhal number, which is a dimensionless number that describes oscillating flow phenomena. This Struhal number empirically is 0.2 for a cylinder-shaped kind of bluff body and a certain range of Reynolds numbers. For those who care, it's about maybe 1,000 to 200,000. So this Struhal number is equal to a length term, which is the diameter of the cylinder, times the frequency of the shedding all over the velocity. So we know the Struhal number is 0.2. We know the cylinder diameter. You know, in our experiment, we can vary the cylinder diameter. This is all in a flow tank. We can dial up the speed, so we can achieve what the shedding frequency, the expected vortex shedding frequency is. And if we know what that expected vortex shedding frequency is, then, well, we know what the velocity is, so we can back out what the wavelength, the spacing of the vortices are. And so schematically, I'm trying to show how we're holding one variable constant, changing the other over here. So let's say we have a small cylinder. This is like, I think it's 2.5 centimeters. And we put it in kind of slow flow, shown by these little short arrows. Right? You might have something like a wake wavelength of 11 centimeters and a shedding frequency of like 2.2 hertz. Right? What happens if we just crank up that flow, just double the speed? You'll see that the wake wavelength, the spacing, stays the same. They're just shedding faster, right? So the frequency doubles. Now, what happens if you swap out this small cylinder, you put in another cylinder that's 5 centimeters diameter, same flow speed. But then what you do is the frequency drops back down to that of the first situation, but the wake wavelength is almost doubled. That's because the vortices are larger, right? And so this is the kind of approach that we had. We're basically going to subject fish to different vortical flows and see what they do. So here's our setup here. It's in schematic view. We've got a float tank, which is kind of like a treadmill for fish. We have our swimming trout in this case. Here's our D-shaped cylinder. We have our high-speed video camera. And so we're looking at the silhouette of the fish, right? And so this is what like a 10-centimeter rainbow trout looks like when it's swimming in smooth flow, no vortices or anything like that. Now the same fish, same flow speed, all we do is we just put a cylinder in the float tank. And this is what it does. So you can see it's being buffeted in the wake quite dramatically. It's kind of flapping back and forth almost like a flag, right? And instead of calling it this flappy motion, I just decided to call it the Karman gate after Theodore von Karman, who kind of came up with the Karman vortex tree. So I'll be referring to this as the Karman gate from here on in. So it looks quite passive, and so the next question, we're like, well, how is this fish interacting with the vortices? It would be great to kind of visualize the vortices in real time. And so for that, we turn to digital particle image velocimetry, which is a flow visualization technique. So what you do simply is you put particles, these 12 micron kind of near neutrally buoyant glass particles with silver on the inside. It just looks like dust, right? You put it in the flow tank, looks like slightly dirty water. And then you shine a very weak laser light sheet through the flow tank, and it lights up all the particles. And so we have two high-speed video cameras that are synchronized to each other. The first is pointed at a 45-degree mirror under the float tank, so you're looking up at the silhouette of the fish against the light sheet. So that's what camera one sees. And then camera two is aimed at a 45-degree mirror kind of higher up in the water column in the float tank. So it's looking down on the uninterrupted light sheet here. So the trout is underneath this. And the reason why we do that is because we've had the trout in the laser before. It doesn't harm them. They seem to ignore it. But anything to the side of it, it will be a shadow. So you can't really, analyze that. Right? And so that's the general idea. And if you were to ask, typically the fish, when we gather the data, is about a centimeter underneath that light sheet. And the idea here is that these kind of vortices that are shed, we try to make it two-dimensional. They're columnar, just like that cylinder. But the height of the fish is actually quite small, so the interaction of the fish with these larger vortices probably doesn't make a huge difference, although we haven't yet visualized the wake behind the trout swimming.
Just a question. You don't have to restrain the fish, or they don't move in the Y position or X position, or they just stay in the...
They kind of prefer to be behind there. So anecdotally, what happens is you put a fish that's never seen a float tank or a cylinder, and it will kind of swim around. And once it kind of senses that vortex streak, it'll kind of get in it, and then it'll kind of hold station there for hours even. Yeah?
So is there any way to figure out how much work they do? So you said that it's waving like a flag, but the flag is passive.
Right.
So presumably, but the flag, if it's not attached, would drift back.
Right.
So presumably not completely passive.
No.
On the other hand, it sounds like they do much less work in the wake than in the free stream.
Yeah. The only way I know how to do it experimentally is to measure the oxygen consumption as they're doing this behavior. And I've got a slide later on that I'll show you that's what we do. We basically got this expensive respirometer to kind of measure the cost. We also measure the muscle activity, and I'll show you that too. But that would be my experimental approach to do it. Any other questions so far?
Do they eat little particles?
They do. This is totally, the whole talk is going to be, outlined by all these questions. But yeah, they do. And we're starting to get interested in what the control strategy is to kind of intercept these particles.
It's just from the gate. It looks like they get to sweep twice the distance without the work.
Yeah, so one of the questions was, do they wait till they get to one side to intercept, or will they always come out of the vortex street to grab food if there is food? And the punchline is they'll always come out of the street to get food. When there is food, they won't time it. Yeah?
If somehow you rotate the cylinders at 90 degrees, so will the fish motion sort of correlate now then because before you were describing it's moving up and down, right? Follow become left and right, or?
So the up and down in the video was side to side in real life, but
oh, I see.
But the cylinder, I know what you're saying, the cylinder is here. The axis of the fish and the way it undulates is this way.
Yes.
Right? But if you did this, then the fish, we haven't done it, it kind of becomes a little much more unstable. But there are fish that like flounder that kind of are like this, and you'd think that they would probably be able to exploit the vortices. But it's very important, the axis of the vortices and the axis of undulation. But to answer your question, yeah, they would be much more. Yeah.
So if you have a transparent cylinder, let's say a glass or something, will this still swim in the center? Like, so the question is it visually mediated or it's just flow detection in the center?
So let me see, are you saying if you... Were you saying if you move the cylinder?
No, if you...
It's invisible,
thank you. It was invisible. We bought these plexiglass cylinders, but they're never that clear. So that's an experiment that remains to be done. But there is a visual component to it. So it'd be interesting if there was... We thought about ideas like we had a hologram of the cylinder with the cylinder in it, and then we removed the cylinder so they could still see the, you know, what would they do?
How about disturbed waters?
About what?
Turbid waters.
Turbid waters? Yeah, we could do that. Totally muddy water and then try to... Yeah, that would be a good experiment to do someday.
Good for PIV as well.
Good for PIV. Yeah, you get two birds with one stone. That's right, we'll just like dump like 10 times the amount of particles in there. Yeah. We can't even see the fish.
Do you have videos of blind fish during this experiment?
Do I have fish?
Videos of blind fish? Like fish that are
blind fish. Yeah. Fish in the dark we have. I actually didn't show videos of it. I haven't, but maybe I can put them there and I'll show you. Yeah, but we did do a study where we knocked out the lateral line and we played around with vision. So we had in the light with lateral line and the light without lateral line, in the dark, you know, and all that. And I'll mention that.
But you image the fish when it's in the dark?
In infrared. Yeah, so it attenuates quite quickly in water. But if you put shine the infrared light against a white background, so you just lose the silhouette. Yeah, that works pretty well. Yeah.
Are the particles and the fish imaged in the same channel? Do you image them at the, are they different like wavelengths or something?
Oh, I see. There are different channels, but I guess you could, if you wanted, yeah, you could, you know, use different channels, I guess, if you wanted to.
But you don't have an issue with, when you're using the PIV, that the fish affects the calculation of the flow field?
No, yeah, not if the fish is kind of above it. If you want to actually get the flow at the, kind of like the boundary layer on the body, or you want it up against there, then you'd have to have some masking to be able to retrieve it. But yeah. All good questions. Any other questions? Before I show you a light video of what this looks like. All right, so this is what this looks like. Here's the trout. It's carmengating. And I should mention to you that this carmengating is, they usually do it from like three tail beats, so tail beats, you know, side to side, 3 to 6 tail beats. And then there'll be some corrective motion, and then it'll do it again. So it's not like they lock on and they just do this, you know, for, you know, I loop my movie so it looks like that, but they'll do it from like, yeah, 2 to 7 tail beats, but they'll stay in this vortex street for hours. So what we did in the beginning was we put these fish in kind of laminar flow, we cranked up the flow, and in like 5 or 10 minutes, if you crank up the flow fast enough, they'll hit the back of the baffle, they get tired, right? And then if you put the cylinder in there, they'll just stay there for like hours. Hours and hours. You can go, get lunch, come back, just a little bit.
Yeah, slow down
a bit
right now.
Yeah, slow down a bit. No, let's see. Not 2 times, maybe? Maybe 2 times, something like that. It's not a fast behavior. I think that the shedding frequency of the cylinders are usually 2 to 3 hertz.
Jimmy, when you call this a gate, a different gate from the other gates,
right.
Are you using a physiological consideration or just a kinematic one?
It's mostly a kinematic one, and we kind of, I remember when I first came out with this, we debated whether to call it a gate, because aren't there enough gates in fish swimming and whatnot? But we basically based it off the terrestrial literature. We thought, you know, with a horse, like the trot and gallop, those kinematic differences, you know, this difference from free stream swimming is at least those kind of kinematic differences of terrestrial literature.
So what so you just said suggested that there might also be a physiological gate because it doesn't get tired. In the other case, it gets tired.
That's true, right. We didn't know that at the time, but I agree. So it, physiologically, something's very different that's going on. I'll show you the muscle activity in a little bit later. So I've seen a zillion of these movies, so I can actually see the vortices, you know, as the fish are kind of going back and forth. But what's helpful is we do kind of a heat map showing you the circulation counterclockwise, clockwise of the vortices in real time with the fish. So that's this next slide over here. We have the cylinder, right? And again, the heat map is blue for clockwise flow, and red for counterclockwise vorticity, angular velocity. And mapped on top of that is the velocity vectors. So these black arrows, the length shows you kind of how strong the flow is, and the direction is obviously the direction of the flow. And you see when the arrows tip up, the fish moves up. The arrows tip down, the fish moves down. So it's going with this lateral component of the flow, but not the upstream, downstream component, or else it would just be drifting down, right? And so the thing that pops out to me is that, the first thing that popped out was that the fish is slaloming between the vortices, right? Alternatively, it could run its head into the center of each vortex. And it turns out if you do that, you swim a lot more efficiently, but you have to generate a lot more power. And I say this because at a collaborator at MIT, we did this with flexible foils, and that's what he discovered. And so slaloming in between these vortices, it looks fairly passive. I should mention that when you put these fish in the flow tank for the first time, there's a bit of a learning component, which we've never even addressed yet, but it might be interesting to this crowd. When you put the fish in, it'll actually hit its head against the cylinder a few times before it realizes, hey, I've got to stay back a little bit so I don't get caught in this suction zone, right? And so we've tried this in probably 60 species of fish. And we tried to get fish that were, they lived in streams. We tried to get fish that never saw water flow. So I'd go to these golf ponds in Cambridge and try to get these bluegill sunfish that I was like, all right, these fish have never seen flow. And they all will do it. It's just that there's a learning component to it. They have to figure out how to stay in this saddle point, this sweet spot, not too close to the cylinder, and obviously not too far back. Because if you're too far back, then you don't really get to exploit the energy of the vortices. And that's essentially what the fish are doing. Yeah?
Probably a trivial question, but what would a dummy fish look like? An object of the same buoyancy?
Nice. We tried. I'll show you a video later on where we tried to, being an angler, I have there's thousands of lures in my garage where, you can just put them in. They're fish shaped, they're flexible. And we couldn't get it to do this behavior. I should say, to an outsider, it would look similar. But to us, we're like, that's not exactly what's going on. But I'll get to that in a couple slides. Yeah?
Maybe you explain a little bit the graph. So color means vorticity.
Yes.
But it's not actually producing a velocity field, so you separate the different time scales. So what's going on? What is vortice? If you piece here, you don't see the vortex in the center of the red dot. Maybe it's illusion. Maybe it is.
Yeah.
If you look at the velocity
field. Oh, I see. Velocity field, yeah.
If you forget color, can you show me where the vortex is?
Oh, I see. Yeah. I've never tried to forget the color.
Could not make sense of vortex and velocity field.
Yeah. I guess I haven't really looked at it and tried to forget the color.
The background velocity is right.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
So
background is subtracted from it. Background velocity is subtracted from it. Thank you, Reverend.
Mathematically, it's the curl of velocity.
I see.
Right, forgot to mention that, right? We subtract the background flow, which was about, 4.5 body lengths of the fish. The fish is about 10 centimeters or so. So there's a sweet spot, and then we've had other experiments where we changed the cylinder diameter, we changed the fish length. It turns out that the fish has to be about at least two body lengths, or the cylinder, the fish has to be about two cylinder diameter lengths, right? So the ratio of fish length to cylinder size makes a big difference. You can imagine that, because a really small cylinder, really tiny vortices, they ignore it. Really big cylinder, they're caught in a whirlpool. They can't really do this behavior. Yeah?
So you mentioned that going straight into the vortices would be more efficient, but did you test this out with the fish? Have a target? Should they not be the target?
Yeah, we haven't, but we thought of an idea where So the fish just really cares about kind of saving energy and hanging out here. But we can imagine we scared the fish and it had some motivation to move really quickly. You might see it kind of spear into one of the vortices. But we haven't really done that in the live fish.
And so I mentioned you cannot reach speed at which you get turbulent wing.
Pure turbulence? Yeah, not in our float tank. We can only go maybe about a meter or so.
So, I mean, the fish would not be able to follow at that speed, or?
We're a little constrained by the dimensions of the tank. If we had, we could have a larger float tank, and we can generate higher speeds. I think the fish would still be able to match the speed. In the wild, I've tried to do this in some kind of fishery stations where they divert part of the stream into a warehouse, and instead of 1 meter a second, they get 10 meters a second, and we can still see the fish do this kind of behavior. But in our small float tank, you get constriction of the vortices on the walls, and so things aren't as straightforward. Yeah, Jane.
It might be helpful to plot the pressure field that will get on the surface of fish directly. The velocity actually, especially on the boundary, that will give you the pressure distribution.
Right.
So that would be very intuitive, even though I think the reason the vorticity gives us intuition is because it's related to the pressure actually on the surface.
Right.
But your vorticity is above the fish, so it's a little hard to infer.
Yeah.
So it might be a little different exactly where the fish level.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's high time to be able to visualize the flow on the surface of the fish as it's doing this, and then the pressure field would be great. And we try to indirectly get at that by, later on I'll show you some slides where we put pressure sensors along a 3D printed fish to kind of see what the pressure signal is along the fish.
I think on the surface, you can actually relate the pressure to
velocity.
To vorticity.
That would be a great experiment to do. Yeah.
How does this? So the one Kalman voltage street is has a different scale that's decided by the D cylinder and the flow.
Right.
And the fish has its own size. How does the size relate to what it does? Do you see small fish do this differently or?
Yeah. We played around within the constraints of our flow tank with the different. Size cylinder. It's just easier to swap out cylinders and have fish of different sizes. But when the cylinder is small, let's say it's half this size, you'll see the fish kind of what I'm calling kind of like free stream swimming, like normal swimming, but they just kind of get buffeted once in a while. So it'd be different from free stream swimming, but you don't see these kind of large undulations at all. And we've never been able to have a large enough cylinder in that flow tank to really see what the effect on the upper limit of that is. But it's very sensitive to size, and to the point where my dream experiment is we have this, infinitely large float tank, and you set up cylinders of different sizes and put just thousands of fish of different sizes, they'll probably sort themselves out. Mm. They'll probably, I was thinking we could patent that for an aquaculture, technology where you can just self-sort fish and then, or you can put like posts in the stream and say 10-inch trout over here for anglers and 20-inch trout over here. So they sort themselves out. And anglers know this, they, a bigger rock, be a bigger fish. But this is what's going on, and it's not, and I'm not showing you any data on this, but, when I show this to people are like, oh, that's great, but, the fish, there's a velocity deficit behind you. The water's slower behind there, so maybe they're just there because the water's slower. Who wouldn't swim in a place that's slower, right? And then, what we're showing, I'm not showing you this figure, but we do swim the fish at this average velocity deficit. So this velocity is about half that of the free stream flow. So we'll swim these fish, the same fish, in that velocity. We'll measure muscle activity and oxygen, and we'll see that regardless, it's still saving more energy when it's doing this behavior. So I think it's definitely exploiting, recapturing the energy of the vortices in addition to being in that velocity deficit. Yeah?
So, you just said that this could be a sorting of the fish by size relative to the size of the object. Mm-hmm. But is there like a window over which a fish of a given size can adapt?
Oh, can adapt.
Basically, the size of the vortices up to a certain. How would they do that?
Yeah. Well, again, I won't show you this data, but we analyzed the kinematics, the body motions of the fish as it's doing it. And it turns out when the fish is swimming in the vortex stream, the body wavelength, right, is much longer than it is when it's swimming in the free stream. So in the free stream, there might be one sine wave on the body of the fish. And in the vortex stream, it's much longer than that. Right? There's not one half sine wave or something like that on there. So I can imagine if you put one fish one size and start changing out the cylinder sizes, that you might see the fish still stay in that position, but the body wavelength might change. That might accommodate. Because it really all just depends on the angle of the flow to the surface, the control surface of the body, you know, the fins as well as the axial body musculature.
So any idea how they would do that? I mean, how do they sense the length?
Oh, nice.
Of this and then adjust?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we've looked into the lateral line and to see if that's the case, but at this point, I don't really know. I don't really know how they're doing it. You know, I first want to document that they are doing it first, and then we can do things like ablate the lateral line. It's a little heavy-handed. We use pharmacological agents, you know, to kind of block like cobalt chloride, but it, like wipes out all the lateral line. So it'd be nice to have a more sophisticated way, and that's kind of how I got into the zebrafish electrophysiology. But you know, it's a far step from this. Okay, so there's a learning component to this. There's a sweet spot. The fish is kind of flapping, you know, like a flag, but there is still some active component, hopefully. And so what controls this? Is it active or passive? And the way you can do this is you can use a technique called electromyography, right? And so fish have these axial muscles that are arranged serially down the body, right? You see it here in the trout. And what you can do, it's essentially acupuncture for fish. So you put these fine wire electrodes with a needle in a anesthetized fish under surgery. It's just under the skin into both the red and the white muscle. So the red muscle is the kind of aerobic muscle that fishes use. There's a little strip of it underneath the skin. For the zebrafish people out there, these are like secondary motor neurons that innervate this. Most of the fish they eat in your fillet at home, is white muscle, axial white muscle, anaerobic, right? And so this is the muscle that's used when a fish sea starts, right? It's anaerobic, so they can go really fast, you know, but they can't go very long. And so we put these electrodes in both the red and white. It turns out the white they don't really use at all, surprise, surprise, during this behavior. They're mostly using these red muscles, which are involved in routine swims. So these wires kind of come out. We crazy glue them all together. There's eight kind of wires that come out and get amplified. So what you can do with this technique is you can figure out when the muscle is active and where it is because, you know, we placed it in these certain areas. And after the experiment's over, we euthanize the animal. We dissect out the electrode placement so we know exactly, did we really get the red muscle? Did we get the white muscle? Where is it exactly?
This aerobic and anaerobic is also during learning? Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure what happens during the learning. But I'm pretty sure that during this behavior, it's mostly red muscle from what we can tell. But if you were to scare it and it would kind of swim into a vortex, that might be white muscle. Okay, so I'm going to show you these four electrode insertion sites in kind of the next slide, arranged kind of in a different manner. So here's the fish again. Here are the four electrode insertion sites. This first column is the fish swimming in the free stream flow, right? And so what you see is that there's a propagating wave of red muscle activity that goes from head to tail. So there's a sequential activation, right? And that's what causes the body to bend into a wave and push on the water and move forward. Right? That's how fish swimming kind of works. Same fish.
Sorry, what's your time scale here?
Oh, sorry. This time scale? Let's see. That would be, I don't know, maybe I'm going to guess. 250 milliseconds? Something. Oh, for the red? Yeah, right. I mean, I'd say the tail beat frequency is probably about 2 or 3 hertz. Okay. Something like that. Yeah. Not very fast. So not 50 or 60 or anything like that. So the same fish, same flow, same electrode. We just put a cylinder in front of it. And so that's what you see. But the interesting thing is, like, clearly half the body is not activating any of its muscle. Right? So it's really just the the muscles near the head that are activating at all. And so what's going on? Is it contracting muscles in its head to steer? You know, is it, are they steering into a vortex or steering away from a vortex? At that point, we didn't really know for sure.
You tried putting on both sides just to check that they were activating?
Yeah, we did put them on both sides. It wasn't like they were contracting simultaneously. It was definitely one side versus another side. And something I won't show is that, you know, they can do it with their axial musculature, but they also have fins. And so a lot of times you'd see no activity at all on the body, and then you'd see a fin, and they would just turn, just the way you kind of reverse a stroke in a canoe. So you'd have to do the experiment on finless fish, but we didn't do that. So sometimes you'd see, like, no muscle activity on the axial. Yeah.
You mentioned that if you put these in a different cylinder, they may adapt their your body weightless and stuff.
They could, yeah.
And so between those, like, let's say you could do that in a dynamic way, between those transitions there may be some activity throughout the entire body.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would almost bet on that. I think you'd see that transition here. That's the only way to see it because, you know, visually you wouldn't know what's passive and what's active.
And so this this situation in which the first one is active is just when they're already kind of in their
yes.
steady state.
Right, not transition. So now the whole project would be transitioning in and out and seeing how they do that. We're very interested in that, and I think feeding is the way to do it. Like, we can throw pellets and they'll come out and they'll come in, and that transition between vortex street and free stream flow would be very interesting for us. Yeah, that's a great question. So this was satisfying to us. We were like, okay, it's kind of what's going on. Reviewers weren't that satisfied because they were like, well, sure, they're contracting as many muscles, but, you know, maybe it costs a whole lot to contract up here, right? And so how are you gonna get at that? So we basically threw money at the problem. We bought this $70,000 mason jar, right? Just basically, we put the fish in there, screwed the top on, right? And we measure the oxygen consumption. Right? This is getting at the work question. And so what's nice about this respirometry system is that you don't have to unscrew the mason jar, stress the fish out, you know, reoxygenate the mason jar, put the fish back in and make another recording. This is automated, so the mason jar is sitting in a pool of oxygenated water with a port, so you can kind of reflush, right? So you can do multiple trials and measure the oxygen consumption of these fish. And so that's what we did. We kind of cranked up the flow. And for fish that are swimming without a cylinder, we saw that the oxygen consumption would go up as you increase the flow velocity. But now the same fish behind a cylinder at the same flow speed doesn't use as much oxygen. So this is the kind of the definitive kind of way we could say, hey, they're actually saving energy. Because how else do you calculate energy in a, experimentally, you know, in a fish? So they use less energy. If you don't believe that, here's a dead fish. Yes.
How much does it correspond to the lowering of the frequency of oscillation? Did you check that? You know? What was the frequency
oscillation
that they would use when they're just by themselves and when they
have this? Oh, I see. Yeah, it would be by themselves are probably about 6 hertz. And then you put the cylinder in there and then cylinder is about 2-3 hertz, so it drops it about half. And it matches the when they drop their tailbeat frequency, it matches that of the expected vortex shedding frequency. They're really synchronized. They go from 6 hertz to let's match the vortices. With some corrected motions once over. Yeah.
So when you do the comparison, you do the comparison between the laminar flow and the
for this one here.
And the and the actual, like, but the, if you take the original of slow velocity in between the
vortices, yeah,
then you would have more or less the same thing, or is
you still so you're saying the reduced velocity?
Yeah, like if you imagine just that it was swimming in between the vortices.
Yeah. It still saves more energy behind that cylinder. So it's actually exploiting. It's not just the velocity deficit. It's not just swimming in the slower flow. It's actually recapturing energy from the vortices to propel itself forward. Yeah, we did do that experiment. It's, you know, there's a graph in one of the papers.
How does
the
mason jar work? Sorry.
Oh, the mason jar? basically, so we have the flow tank respirometer. There's a cover that you seal over it. You know, it's got a gasket, and so the only thing that going in and out of it, you know, at this point is this oxygen probe, right? And then what you don't see down here is there's a port that is in contact with a larger body of water. So this is the flow tank here, but it's actually in a bath of more water, And then so the idea is that once you run down the oxygen, because the fish is consuming it, you want to do another trial, then you can inject oxygenated water back into this to bring it back up to 100%.
And this is in the whole flow tank? Or?
The whole flow tank, yeah. It's in the whole flow tank.
And how is this number comparing with the drug?
With the drug?
Yeah.
Which drug? Oh, the drag. The drag. How do you mean? How does this which number?
On the power.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how I'd answer that. Yeah, I'm not sure how I'd answer that. The drag on the fish? No, it's kind of it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. So we haven't. It'd be great to know what the drag is on our freely swimming fish, but experimentally, it'd be tough. Probably computationally, you could arrive at something. Yeah.
What are the curves and frequency for this data?
How is the curve fit?
Yeah. What are the curves? I mean, do you have a theoretical prediction for that, this relationship?
No, this is just all empirical, all the measurements that we had, you know, that we actually had. So there's no kind of theoretical, you know, basis for it. Is there another question behind that question?
No, okay. You have a straight line, so it looks like a fitting curve, but on top of the data.
Yeah, right. Yeah, this is kind of what we came up with.
Can I measure the fish's body weight or something?
The body weight? Yeah, after the experiment or even before the experiment, we could measure the body weight. Yeah. And actually that comes into play when you calculate the oxygen consumption. It's kind of normalized to the body weight of the fish. Yeah.
So is the oxygen being measured at different places throughout the tank or just that one?
It's just measured at that one spot. Yes.
Okay. And that's representative of?
It is if you waited a long enough time, because in the respirometry field, they really like small flow tanks and big fish, right? Because they can use up the oxygen really quickly. So in 20 minutes or so, you can get some kind of recording. But for biomechanics, we want an infinitely large flow tank, but you know, then you have to wait a long time to get that oxygen.
Oh, I see. So you let it come to steady state and figure out how much oxygen you're putting back.
Yeah.
I see. So it's not like at different times throughout the motion.
It's not that instantaneous. Although there are much more kind of time-resolved oxygen probes now where you can imagine putting it near the fish, you know, or maybe even just fixing it behind a gill of a fish or something, potentially. Although that would cause some interference with the swimming.
I may be getting ahead, but we know that cyclists will often do something very similar.
Right. Drafting.
The drafting, and that's also helps them save energy. Runners do it. Yeah. Do schooling fish do this?
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially a model of a swimming fish. So the flow behind a cylinder is a drag wake. So the way those vortices are turning into each other is a drag wake. In a fish, a thrust wake, they're spinning away from each other. So a cylinder, hydrodynamically, is kind of similar to two fish swimming side by side. So in that sense, it would work. The cheat is that the cylinder is really tall, right, compared to the fish. So those vortices are very strong. But if we had just had a little short cylinder or a sphere or something like that, that would be the test to see if a fish would actually make use of that.
Or just have a mechanical fish.
Yeah, that's right. So that's another project that we would love to do, is just heave two fish and see if the fish would actually position itself the way you'd expect it. Theoretically, it should be in a diamond formation, so it'd be interesting to see if the schooling fish would get behind two kind of robotic fish. Question?
How much does the Carmen Street phenomenon depend on this, how cylindrical the obstruction is? Because in nature, you probably don't have these cylinders, right? But they may still have these.
Yeah, right. We haven't really explored that too much, but I'll tell you the reason why we went to the half cylinder is in a round cylinder, the separation point for the vortices can kind of wiggle, right? Like where the vortex spins off. You're allowing it to separate wherever it wants. And because it can kind of shed off different points, you're going to get a shedding frequency that's got some variation. So maybe it's not 2 hertz, maybe it's 2.5 hertz, maybe it's 1.7 hertz. So by cutting it in half, we fix that sharp trailing edge, right? And so it has to shed at that point. So it cleans up the shedding frequency. Because at that point, we're really interested in, is the fish tailbeat frequency dropping down to match that of the vortex shedding frequency? But, you know, we've done things like put, you know, plates, you know, in there, and you also see some shedding as well. But we haven't kind of really explored that to see, you know, how round it has to be to foster those vortices.
Would you reasonably certain this type of thing would be happening in nature with your shaped boulders?
Yeah, right. I mean, this is two-dimensional, but if it was a boulder, yeah, it would probably have, there's probably some range and height where you have these vortices, but then there'd be three-dimensional flow, you know, the z-axis. And then you can see that in fish in the field, like they'll get kind of bump up and down as well as doing this. But we've tried to kind of make the experimental setup a little more complicated by putting two cylinders in tandem and changing the distance, you know, side by side. So we're just starting to get a little more complex with it. Yeah.
I was just wondering why you see comparable response in the electromyograph in the previous slide when you compare it to the next slide where you put the dead fish, where you see how it gets sucked into this zone somehow. So why does it even need to swim?
Why does it even need to swim? That's a great question. All right, so let's go to this dead fish swimming. Okay, so let me just give you background. This movie's looped. We're using kind of non-stretching line here, and the fish is hooked up by the head region, right? And so what's happening here is the fish is kind of being buffeted in the wake, but at certain times it synchronizes with the vortex streak just right that actually moves upstream on its own, right about here, maybe. That and then it got caught in the suction region, hits its head, flops back down, and starts over and over again. So I'm not so interested in what's going on here because this line is tight. If I cut the line, it floats downstream. But at certain points, the body, due to the passive intrinsic properties of its flexibility, passive musculoskeletal properties, makes it so that the fish can extract energy from the vortices and move upstream passively.
Is that just before it gets smashed into the cylinder? Is that always ending with the fish getting into the cylinder
It usually always keeps going up into the suction zone. The suction zone, so if I were to draw it, it'd probably be about here. And so it's close enough, and if it gets caught in the suction zone, up it goes. And that's the big difference between a live fish and a dead fish, is that a live fish, after it does this 2 or 3 times, it knows, okay, I'm going to put on the brakes with my fins and my muscles and stay back here. A dead fish will hit the cylinder all day. And so it's interesting because the flexibility of the fish is what allows it to do this. For those of you that sail, it's kind of like a nautical analogy of tacking, right? This is the body of the fish, the surface area of the fish is acting as both the sail and the rudder, right? So it's moving upstream basically on its passive properties. Now, unlike a windmill can extract energy from the environment. A turbine can extract energy from the environment in steady flows, right? But it produces drag. It doesn't propel itself forward at all. In oscillating flows, it's a different story. Right? You can actually recapture energy to propel yourself forward without any net power input. So David Beale, who's a colleague of mine at MIT, he was inspired by this work, and he used flexible foils, and he followed D cylinders in his tow tank at MIT. Came in the lab that did the RoboTuna, Mike Triantafili's lab, and he showed that without any net power input, you could follow a cylinder with a flexible foil indefinitely. So it doesn't get much more passive than this. So, you know, this is usually the slide that people remember. You know, they're like, oh, the dead fish swimming. Right, of course.
Is it fish on the line here?
It is on the line. That's right, yeah. So we did this just so we could see this phenomenon, but I can imagine if you were patient enough, you could drop a dead fish in there at the right time and it would kind of do this behavior. And we, oh yeah, go ahead.
Do you have the velocity field overlaid with this video?
We do, it's in the paper. Yeah, I don't remember right now, but we did calculate. We also compared it to the live fish.
So it is doing something different than the live fish?
Yeah. It is doing something slightly different from the live fish. When it's in this region, it's pretty similar, but like some things like the head yaw is not quite the same because the head is being tethered rather than freely unconstrained. So we put plastic models in there, and we could not recreate this kind of extraction of energy at all. We tried all sorts of models. We tried even some dead fish. We like defrosted fish and we put them in there and it wouldn't do it, you know. And so it had to be a fish that was freshly dead and still had mucus on it and it didn't undergo rigor mortis. And it was definitely dead, so I always get that question. There's a movie at the end I can show that shows you it's pretty dead. but it was dead. So there must be, you know, it's largely passive, but there must be sensing something, right? And they must be acting appropriately somehow. Like when I'm fly fishing in a stream, I don't see dead fish swimming upstream all the time. So there's some component of control, right? But here's where the behavior is so fascinating and complex. It's not like they want to sense things and they want to, you know, act accordingly. But it's not just to save energy behind the cylinder. They're doing all sorts of other things in there. So this gets at this feeding question that was asked earlier. Here's a pellet of food here, and here's the trout. And if you keep your eye on that little pellet of food, play the movie, you'll see it as it's floating down, the trout will kind of, you know, negotiate to the point where it can actually grab this piece of food that's kind of coming down. Right? And that's what we know, that they really like this behavior, because within 10 minutes of swimming in the vortex street, you can start dropping food in, and they'll come out and grab it. They'll come out and grab it, right?
Was this visual? Or is it a dead
trout? Not a dead trout. That would be a nature paper. Was it what?
Was this mission done with infrared or?
This one was done in the light, so we haven't done it in infrared or in murky water, but that would be a great experiment to do.
Jimmy?
Yes?
Can they tell that this is food and not some Would they eat a piece of plastic?
They would probably eat a piece of plastic if it was the right shape.
So it's unable to tell, like, through chemosensory cues that it's actually food before it's running it?
Yeah, I think on that time scale, I think it's just a visual. I think it's just a visual thing. But what we did was, so we'll feed them, but they get full, and we actually measure the oxygen consumption, but there's something called specific dynamic action, which it means if you eat food, your metabolism changes anyway. So we wanted to feed them without them getting full, so I would sit there in the lab and tie these flies that didn't have hooks on them that looked like a pellet, so we would drop it down, and then we'd, you know, have them eat it, and then we'd pull it back up. But then after you did that for like 4 or 5 times, they would get used to it, so you'd have to take some of the food and put it in the water and get the scent going, and then just put the scent in, and they would get like fired back up. So that could be a project that we could do. so you'd have to kind of get them back up and going again, right?
Jimmy?
Yeah.
In this experiment, the fish isn't really sort of coming out of the vortex street. It's
that was
sort
not.
Of staying in there, and
yeah.
Food is following
right.
The vortex street as well.
That's true. Yeah. For this particular image, not so much, but we'll see them in various kind of regions. Some of them are purely kind of carmagating. And the original kind of experiment was, we thought, since it's kind of passively surveying left and right, whether if you put a piece of food here and it was up here, it would just let it go because,
right.
Hey,
yeah.
I don't want to get out of there. But it turns out as soon as they see the food, they will just go to it. And so this is just the same movie again, showing you that we're, you know, trying to track the particle now. And so we know what the particle position is, we know what the head position is, and so I'm collaborating now with a group at NOAA, Andrew Hine, and we're interested in kind of just starting to kind of wrap our heads around what the control strategy might be of how these fish find these particles in the water. And so we'll do something like we'll kind of track all the particles as they come past the cylinder. We've got this kind of working model that is kind of a hybrid between pure pursuit, just following something, and proportional navigation, so the rate of the bearing angle. You know, the fish turns according to the change in the bearing angle of the target. And the model is okay with predicting kind of when the fish turns, but not very good at changes in velocity of the fish. So here's the time to interception. So this here is when the animal grabs the piece of food, and here's just the swim speed of the animal here. And you see that just before it grabs the food, it kind of, you know, increases its velocity. And the variation in the velocity is actually quite great. But sometimes you'll see that it'll speed up and then slow down to grab the food. Other times it'll just kind of speed up to grab the food. So very much a work in progress, but, you know, that's one of the directions we'd like to head, is to try to understand how they're doing this kind of more complicated behavior behind the cylinder. So let's see, how am I on time? Start at 9. Okay. So So we wanted to get at the sensory cues of what's going on, right? And this is our first iteration was to look at the lateral line system. Vision is a huge component of it as well. I'll talk a little bit about that, but we really haven't done many studies on it. We're focused on the lateral line. And so this is a movie showing you a plunger. This was done in infrared. And as you see this plunger depressed, we're going to shoot a jet of water at the fish. And you'll see the reaction of the fish. And so we use cobalt chloride to kind of knock out all the lateral lines in the trout. And we had them carmingate. And the long story short, when they were carmingating, their kinematics were different. Their body curvature was different. They actually ended up being in a different position behind the cylinder a little bit. That's when it was carmingating. It turns out that if you do the experiment in the light and it can see the cylinder, it'll still carmingate. It'll have these compromised kinematics. But if you do it in the dark, the fish doesn't really prefer to be behind that cylinder. So it will cross the vortex street, and when it does this behavior, those kinematics are very similar to a fish that has an intact lateral line. Not identical, but similar. But the big difference was it didn't prefer to be in the vortex street in the dark. Right? So this kind of motivated me to kind of get a little more mechanistic in terms of the lateral line. This is where we kind of followed the lateral line down a wormhole a bit, and it gets further away from this, but we want to understand how this flow sensing system worked more. So that's when I transitioned over to Joe Fetcher's lab to learn electrophysiology in the zebrafish lateral line. This is also is done in infrared. This is a larval zebrafish, so 5 millimeters length. You can see it in the dark when you shoot a vortex jet at it. It can sense it, and it makes an adaptive behavior. It moves away from it. And this is all because, when you zoom in, the sensory units, of the lateral line are the neuromast, which is a cluster of hair cells, like so. And this is a zoomed-in video that we take in the lab. So here is the surface of the fish, of the zebrafish here. This is one neuromast. It's made up of several hair cells that are projecting up here. So you see the kinocilia, the long hairs over here. And then because it's a very low Reynolds number, everything is very viscous. So we have a glass probe over here that we can control with the piezoelectric device, and we can kind of move it back and forth. And so it's viscously kind of coupled, right? So you can see we can move the hair cells at a given amplitude and frequency.
Is that real time, Jim?
Yes, this one is real time. Which is nice, because in the beginning, we were like shooting jets of water. It'd be really fast, and we'd kind of try to nudge it physically, and then the cupola would get all kind of messed up. This way, we can actually stimulate it. It's still intact.
And so what frequency range do you
We went up to about, I think, 200, the response dropped off after about 100 hertz. So we just show the data from 100 hertz. But we can go up, I think, even probably more than that, even. And so the idea is that these hair cells are innervated by afferent neurons, which we record from. So we record from the neuron as we kind of stimulate in a very controlled way the motions of the neuromast. Okay. So for those of you that don't know, hair cells, I just took this off the website, a textbook. And so basically a pressure wave or water, deflects these hairs. The tip links open, so these kind of cilia and stereocilia get deflected, potassium channels open, membrane just depolarizes, calcium flows in. This causes these synaptic vesicles, which have glutamate in it, fuse and release, and this causes an increase in the firing rate of these afferent neurons. And so that's what we're recording from. We're actually patching on to these afferent neurons in the ganglion as we deflect these hair cells. And so this is what it looks like. The hair cells, the neuromast, I should say, clusters labeled, I believe, in DASP here. You're seeing doublets here because you're seeing clear to the other side of the fish and seeing the other one on the other side, right? So they're paired. And what innervates them is the afferent neurons. So here you see when they're bipolar, so they contact, one neuromast or several neuromasts. Here's the cell bodies located in the ganglion outside the brain that projects into the hindbrain. And the idea is they gather information up and down the body as well as left and right sides to be able to generate an appropriate behavior. And so here's the schematic. Blue is the neuromast. Over here, red is the afferent neuron. And what we do is we stimulate the neuromass and record from the afferent recording. So in this case, we're showing you a sine wave stimulation, but we use white noise stimulation, we use ramp deflections, and we read out what the response of the afferent neuron is. So the spike rate or the vector strength, how kind of synchronized it is to the stimulation. And so here's a graph showing you some of that data for spike rate. So what we do is we ramp up the stimulation frequency. So here we went up to 90 hertz. And this is the normalized kind of spike rate, normalized to the spontaneous activity of individual afferents that we record from. And you can see that it codes it pretty well for lower frequencies, 30 hertz and under. And after that, it kind of plateaus. We look at the vector strength, which is simply how synchronized the spikes are to the stimulation. You see that it's highest in this kind of intermediate range. And so it's possible that these animals could distinguish frequency if you were to believe that they could kind of make use of both of these channels of information. So low frequency might be low spike rate, low vector strength. The high frequency up here might be high spike rate, low vector strength. I've had NSFRU students in the lab try to train fish to see if they can discriminate frequency, but we haven't really, it hasn't been that successful yet.
How old are they when you do recording?
How old is what?
How old is the fish?
Oh, the fish, yeah. I'd say 4 to 6 days post-fertilization. Nothing really older than that. But I should say that if you go to look at the literature, adult fish will be sensitive up to 60 hertz or 100 hertz. So it's interesting that it's already wired in to be able to be sensitive to that. So. Okay, so something else that we found out when we were making these recordings. So here's a schematic again. We're recording from the afferent neuron. This is the firing response to the afferent neuron. We're stimulating the neuromass. This time it's just a ramp stimulation. So we just deflect it to one side and just hold it there. And when we see that, we can see there's an increase in afferent firing rate, but we can also record from the muscle activity. So it's kind of like the EMG for the live trout, but this one's in a paralyzed larval zebrafish, so we know what the activity is. And when we see that, what happens is if you stimulate just a single neuromast, you can elicit muscle activity. Stimulate it.
Are you recording from the muscle or from the muscle nerves? You're facing the
actual
on the axon
of the motor neurons? Yeah, that's it. It's a retroreflex.
So you're seeing like all of the motor neurons?
All the motor neurons in that area. Yeah, exactly. So multiple units. Yeah. Yeah, so it'd be interesting to patch like a single motor neuron in the spinal cord and see. So this is interesting. So go ahead.
You also, coming back to the electromyogram, where you show the normal spinning, the droplets, that you have coming from anterior to posterior, that the activity is not exactly at the same time. So can you do a similar experiment so you can show that it's actually
You can, actually. So you'd use paired kind of recordings, and you'd look to see if it's an anterior to posterior wave. And actually, there's a behavior in zebrafish called struggling, where the really only diagnostic is to have two ventral root recordings. And for there, you see the tail initiating the wave and it going from tail to head. Not in this one,
Okay.
But if you, behaviorally, when you suck water out of his, a little plate and the fish starts to kind of lash back and forth, that's struggling. But we don't see it when we stimulate a single nerve. So this is all just swimming. All right.
Is this an example of spontaneously active, no? In our recordings, like when we teach people how to use the virtual nerves,
that's right.
They don't know what to do, they get the
Venturi or on the lateral line?
No, the lateral line.
Yes, tons of spontaneous activity, depending if you have multiple units or single units. But yeah, there is. Every afferent neuron that you patch is going to have some background spontaneous activity to it. Yeah. So with this kind of setup, what we're trying to do is figure out what the transfer function is that relates spiking activity to motor activity. So that's what this graph is. So this is a normalized afferent spike rate, and this is the motor response probability. And so what this means is that if you were to tell me what the spike rate for a particular afferent neuron is, I could tell you with some probability if it's going to swim or not. Right? And again, this is just for a single neuromass.
Are you trying the stimulation in two directions? Because you tell me that the connectivity should be that they only connect to nerve cells that would be detecting either the anterior, posterior, right?
Yeah, right. We haven't stimulated, I think, from posterior to anterior. All of them have been anterior to posterior. Yeah, all of them anterior to posterior.
Do you expect the afferent nerve to receive from both sides of the facet?
No, just from one. Yeah, just from one. I think we maybe just got lucky to be able to get the right polarity. Yeah, but yeah.
How do you pick the tendon where you calculate the spike rate?
Oh, calculate the spike rate. I mean, back in here?
Right.
For here?
Yeah, is that kind of like the average spike rate?
Yeah, it is, and I'm trying to remember. I don't know exactly. I might be feeling 50 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds or something like that. Yeah, I forget exactly. That would make a difference, obviously.
Well, that's just something to look at. Like, you know, I mean, here it looks like, you know, this bike rate seems to
work. Right, that's true. Yeah, I think we did like the first 50 milliseconds or when we did the actual ramping up. After that, you know. Okay, but it always does drop. So you notice that even if we stimulate the maximum, you know, the afferent to spike at 100%, we don't still get 100% probability of swimming. So a lot of times they will swim, but it's not a guarantee. Right? And the neuromast, we probably did a range in the middle of the body, so it wasn't always the same. So our kind of simple model of what's going on is a kind of perceptron model or a spike integrator model where the brain might just count spikes, right? I'd be interested in people's feedback later on about this. But the idea would be that, you know, there's a first certain time window in this gray kind of box over here. There's a certain number of spikes, right? And caused by maybe a deflection of this neuromass. And that might not be enough to get the animal to swim away. But if there's additional spikes, right? Maybe it's the spontaneous activity of other, you know, neuromass, or maybe it's the evoked activity, so a water jet that stimulates not just that one, but all along the body. That might cause the spikes to cross some kind of threshold, and the animal would swim away. So under this model, you know, stimulating one neuromass 100% is the same as stimulating two neuromass 50%. So the way the lateral line system is, it's a kind of distributed sensory system all along the body. It's not just in the nose or in the eyes. And that way, it's much more sensitive than any one neuromast on itself should be. We're doing on time. Okay, so I'm just going to go over a couple other components of this. We're starting to get interested in the efferent system, which is this corollary discharge that happens when the animal swims. And so far, we've been looking at kind of sensory information coming in, and then through the brain and the motor activity. But when the animal swims, there's also a copy command that goes out to the neuromass, the efferent system. We've shown this here in yellow. These efferent neurons are in the hindbrain, other regions of the brain, and they make contacts onto these hair cells. And the idea is it kind of gains down the sensitivity when it's actually swimming. So pay attention to biological.
Yeah, the paranagic and what is a neuromodulator that is?
For the cholinergic, acetylcholine, right? I'm not sure about serotonergic, but dopaminergic for sure. Yeah, and that's one that we haven't paid as much attention to. Their cell bodies are kind of located in a different region that we're looking, but something that we'd like to look at. And so these efferent neurons basically make it so you can pay attention to the biologically relevant signals going on. So when a fish swims, this is a study that we did with Hai Bao Dong, computational simulation of a jack, which is a local fresh saltwater fish. You can see that there's a flow that's being generated up and down the body. There's vortices that are being generated along the body and shed into the tail. And so that all supposedly is stimulating the lateral line. And so you don't want to pay attention to that when you're swimming. You want to pay attention to the little fish that's swimming next to you, right? And so that's what the efferent neurons supposedly thought to be doing. And so this is what some of that data looks like. This is Elias Lunsford, who's a PhD student in my lab. What he does is he records from the afferent neurons, and you can see that there's this spontaneous activity, right, that Claire was kind of talking about. These are multiple units. And then when you stimulate the fish to swim, and you do this with flashing a light on it, or you put electrical stimulus on it, this is the ventral root activity, again, multiple units. And when you see the animal swimming, you see there's a clear absence of the afferent signal. So I think that.
How do you go from afferent or efferent for sure? Like, in terms of anatomy?
Oh, afferent or efferent for sure?
Yeah.
The afferent.
You're not using this when you're expressing back here, right?
Sorry, what was that part?
You're just putting the electrode expressor on the end to get a signal.
The electrode is an extracellular patch onto the afferent cell body in the ganglion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's.
Do you know for sure that would be an afferent?
Definitely, yeah. You can't do it in the nerve because all the bundles are together. But if you look in the ganglion, it's afferent. Yeah. And so that's how we make that recording, and then stimulation and then the ventral root. Right? And so if you do the comparison, when the animal's swimming, that spike rate of the afferents is way down compared to when it's not swimming. This is kind of like in using electrophysiological approach. Well, also have done this kind of optically, where here's the neuromass. We're looking down on it in GCAMP 6S fish. And these are all afferent kind of boutons or terminals. And here we're kind of focusing on this little one over here right now. And the protocol here is that we actually shoot a jet of water at the neuromast here when the animal's not swimming. Then we do it while it's swimming, and then we do it again after. And what we see is that when it is swimming, the kind of calcium response is much less than when it is not swimming.
Sorry, what is your driver for the GCAMP?
I think we used a QC panneuronal.
So how do we know which should have the panneuronal?
Yeah, that's right. So we this is kind of the first pass at it. So this is. QC, or do we drive it with something afferent? It might just be QC. And so in that sense, we're not exactly sure if it could be afferent or efferent. But I thought, I'll have to check on that, because I thought we were more specific. I thought we might be more specific on it. But so there is a decrease when it's swimming, so you can believe that either afferent or efferent. Makes sense if it's afferent, because efferent would gain down the process a little bit. And here's just the summary data for multiple trials.
I don't know how you should, but when we tried coughing and looking at the response of the cassettes, they're like very variable for the same cough flow. You get the
same. This is
like you
for.
You don't get a reliable response every time.
Yeah, it was pretty reliable, but are you checking hair cells or the afferent terminal?
Well, for us, we just looked at the hair cells, because we noticed that the afferent is not going to be steady,
even if
you wait long between.
The hair cells, and again, this wasn't many trials. This is not published or anything. This is just stuff that we've been doing. The hair cells, we didn't see any response changes at all, really. It was really just the afferent. We were thinking, oh, the hair cells, they'll do something. We didn't see really any calcium changes in the response. But we didn't do a huge amount. How are we doing on time?
I think you should get to where you want us to be, and then we'll do discussion in the coffee break and in the lab.
Okay, all right, nice. So let me just blow through a few of these. There's some, I'll just quickly sketch out another way we're trying to understand lateral line function in the fish. This is kind of a more mechanical, physical experimentation approach where we know where the sensors are in trout. These are canal neuromasts, not superficial neuromasts that are on the skin of the zebrafish. What we do is we 3D scan the actual specimen, the trout, and then we can print out the heads with these pores where they the sensors are, and then you put actual pressure sensors into the pores, right? So this is what it would look like in a static situation. Here's some of these pressure sensors. They go up here, we read it out, we can kind of position it any direction we want. What we want to do really is to look at it in the moving animal. So what we do is we go to my old advisor's lab up at Harvard, and we borrow his kind of fish heaver, right? And so you can heave the fish back and forth, and you can yaw. You can twist the fish back and forth. So we 3D print some of our fish heads and molds. So we have like a hard head with these plastic soft bodies with little skeleton in it. And then we fly them up there. We put our models onto his flapper, so to speak, and we swim them, right? And the nice thing is you can swim the fish in a way that a real fish doesn't want to swim, right? And so this contraption at the very top here has a six-axis force transducer. So you can read in the motions of swimming. And so we study how real fish swim, so we first input those motions. And we can read out what the drag or the thrust is on that particular motion. But then we can make the fish swim in ways that fish don't usually swim to evaluate, hey, why don't fish swim that way? And we can see if it's less efficient, more efficient, things like that. This is showing you kind of a solid head, but we have ones that 3D printed holes in it, so we put the pressure transducers in there. So we really want to see what the information that's available to a fish-shaped body is. Right? You can't put these pressure transducers on a freely swimming fish, so this is our next best way. We hijack the shape of the fish. We try to see what information is just available. Who knows what they're actually using, but this is what's kind of available. And so this is a plot showing you the frequency in which we heave the fish, right? So half a hertz, 2 hertz, we just shake it back and forth. This is the phase difference between heave and yaw. So here, 0 might be that you heave it to the side and at the very end you twist it. And here, you heave it and halfway through you twist it, right? And here you twist it first and then you heave it, right? That's the phase relationship. And so this color map here is showing you in red what motions result in thrust. Blue is the motions that result in drag, and green is essentially holding position, neither thrust nor drag. And so I'm just going to show you kind of 3 different sections. These are the movies corresponding to it. So these are the motions that you see for each of these areas. So this is pretty draggy, right? It's a fish that's not really swimming well. Here's kind of what a real fish does, propagating wave of motion, head to tail. And then here's one that's kind of on the green side, almost looks like a standing wave. When we put the pressure transducer on the head, we're interested to see if the fish can tell if it's swimming in a thrust-generating way. And so this is kind of just a schematic over one tailbeat cycle showing you that it is possible for the fish to get pressure signals along the head that tell it that it's moving in a thrust generating way. So I'm going to summarize there. Basically, the first question, I talked a little bit about the Karman gate, how it saves energy. This requires sensory feedback. It also is determined on kind of what else it's doing, such as feeding, things like that. Role of ladder line system, kind of ongoing. We're a little further from the Karman gate, but here we're looking at the response frequencies in the lateral line system of the zebrafish, the efferent system, inhibiting spiking, that's something we're actively interested in. And these canal mirror masks with these physical models that I was showing you can recognize optimal swimming. I just want to end by saying that all I did was put a fish behind a stick, right? And I measured a couple behaviors, but they do other behaviors, like right behind the cylinder, they can get in the suction region, and the amplitude envelope is very low, you know. And here it is in front of the cylinder, kind of like a bow wake, like a dolphin, you know, in front of a ship. So there's lots of different behaviors that fish are doing just in regards to a simple bluff body. So there's a lot of other things that could be investigated. So with that, I'd like to thank collaborators, past and present, future, and thank you all for your time.